Thank you for the privilege of opening the book of God to the people of God this morning here in this place. We know that these words are a savor of life unto life to all who will receive them this morning. And I want us to open our Bibles to the book of Jeremiah in the Old Testament. While you're turning, let me just bring you a personal word of greeting from the Annuity Board. We're here on campus this week, Don and Weldon and Mike. A lot of our colleagues are here. We're set up over there by the post office. We've got a book that we've recently written on advice from Daniel on engaging today's culture, a book on culture shock, and I hope it'll be a blessing to you. It's free. You can pick one up over there, and I'm looking forward to seeing many of you for lunch over at Heritage Hall. I'll tell you, the driving motivation behind our lives at the Annuity Board is these next two generations. Right now, we have 9,000 Southern Baptist pastors, and in many cases, in most cases, they're widows that are living on $200 a month or less in benefits because they just never were able to provide for themselves. My passion is to get the next two generations of folks who serve Southern Baptist churches to that place of vocational retirement with some financial security. Solomon said, "Go to the ant, you sluggard, and be wise and consider her ways, because she stores up food in summer, so that when winter comes, she has a harvest." That's good advice for an ant. It's good advice for those who serve Southern Baptist churches. Your generation is going to live longer than any generation in American history and Western culture. And many of you are going to, after your vocational retirement, have 20 or 25 or 30 years of active life and ministry. Could be the greatest, most effective years of ministry in your life. And our dream is to get you to that place of vocational retirement with enough financial security. We believe we can be partners in the harvest and unleash upon this world the greatest force of volunteers on missions all over the world with those most productive years of their lives if they'll just be wise as an ant. So we want to tell you about what we can do for you. We want to be your life partner. And I hope you'll take advantage of these folks that are on campus this week and in a synergistic way, let us be your partner throughout the ministry that you have received from the Lord. It's always a pleasure to be at Southern. Our family has such love and respect for the Moeller family. We see ourselves as true, as in the New Testament word, fellow workers. We get our word synergy from that word, synergistic relationships that come between folks who are called by God. And now for the exposition that's found in the first chapter of Jeremiah. You know, one of the most important motivating factors in life is the concept of purpose, of design. That is, that something, or as we know, rather, someone, is behind it all, forming and fashioning you for a specific purpose and calling that no one can do quite like you can do. Nobody else has a thumbprint like you. No one else has a DNA like you, because you're an individual indescribably valuable to God. There is purpose behind your life. There is design behind your life. And the tragedy is, so many people go through life totally unaware of this fact, that someone is behind it all. In fact, if you want to know who you are or what you're to do, first you must come to grips with whose you are. That there is, in fact, purpose behind you, that there's no one else like you, that you're indescribably valuable to God. And the intent of this message is for you to leave here today with a renewed sense of your worth and of your value, and of the fact that you are not here in this place, in this room this morning by accident, but there is purpose behind your being at this place. There is design behind your life. There are all sorts of markers in life, this mysterion, this mystery of life. There are many markers, life markers along the way. Three primarily for us. One of them is that marker of our birth, where that marker is driven down. For me, it was August 16th, 1947. I'm 55. That would keep you from pausing to add it up. But there's a marker in my life. I was born. And there's going to be a marker over here one day, a second marker, and that's going to be a granite stone if Jesus tarries somewhere, and that's the marker of my death. My dad died about 3 or 4 months ago, and my wife Susie and I just got a marker from my mom and dad's grave. And on that grave, it's got the date of his death on it. It's a marker. It is appointed unto man once to die. And then for those of us who are in this room this morning, along the other many important life markers, there's one other very important one, as we know. And that's that marker we drive down, that Ebenezer, as it were, when we are born again. For some of us, it was very close to this first marker, maybe as a child. For me, it was when I was 17 years of age. The first time I ever remember hearing the gospel. I grew up in Fort Worth, and that when I was 17 and about to graduate from high school and go to college, I didn't know Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were books of the Bible. I was 17 years old. And a young man witnessed to me after a basketball game one day, and then he took me to his church the next Sunday morning. It was the first time I ever heard the gospel, and I received Christ as my Savior that morning. And I drove down that marker in life when I was born again. And then I'm living this life now. One day I'm going to come to that marker, and then I know the hope of heaven that's beyond it. In fact, when we give our personal testimonies, if you really think about it, they're related to those three markers in life. To illustrate that, Paul in Acts 26 gave his testimony before Agrippa. And his testimony basically related around those three life markers. From the time he was born, he said he was born, what, a Hebrew of Hebrews. And he told about his early life. And then he came to that second marker, and he told how on Damascus Road he had the encounter with the living Christ. And then he told what his life had been like since that marker, since he had known Christ. And he came to that place when one day he would die, and he told of his hope that was beyond there, out there in heaven. But the question I have for you this morning is this. What about back there? And if you needed a title for this morning, it just might be, What God Did For Me Before I Was Born. Unless we get off on some theological perversion, you didn't exist back there. Except in the mind of the sovereign Creator God. What God did for me before I was born. You have a testimony of that. And when you leave here this morning, you're going to be able to give testimony, not just of what happened to you here in these life markers, but what happened to you before you were born. What God did for you before you were born. Verse 4 of chapter 1 says, The word of the Lord came to me saying, Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I sanctified you. I ordained you a prophet to the nations. That phrase, before you were born, modifies these four verbs. I knew you. I sanctified you. I ordained you. I formed you. You have a testimony. There is purpose behind your life. There is design behind your life. And if you really want to know who you are, you must first know whose you are. So you have a testimony. Here's the first part of your testimony. You can write it down. It's your testimony. He knew me. What an incredible thought. That's the first part of our testimony of what God did for us before we were born. He knew me. It's an awesome thought. Before my parents ever cradled me in their arms, He knew me. Before I was born, He knew me. Before I was conceived, He knew me. And the word, of course, as many of you know, means far more than intellectual knowledge of you. It carries with it the connotation of a close personal relationship. He knew me. The verb tense indicates that it is past action. It's already done. Before I was born, He already knew me. I didn't have to wait until I formed you, He said, to know you. I didn't have to wait until you were born to know you. I didn't have to wait until you were able to grow up and articulate
words to me. I knew you before you were formed in the womb. Does anyone really know you? You know, as a pastor for over a quarter of a century, I had more than one couples, one set of couples say to me, you know, I've been married to him or her for X years, and sometimes I wonder if I ever have really known them. Does anyone know you? I mean, like you? God does. And this is your testimony. Before you were ever born, He knew you. There is design behind your life. There is purpose behind your life. Back there, before you were ever born, He knew you. Here's the second part of your testimony. He set me apart. Look what He says. Before you were born, I sanctified you. I set you apart. He set me apart. Not only did He know me, but He took me, and the word means He put me off to the side for His own personal pleasure and use. He took me and He sanctified me. He set me apart from everyone else, and He put me off to the side. The word means to separate, to set apart. We get our word sacred from that word. We get our word holy from this word. And again, that the tense tells us that it's past completed action. Before I was ever born, before I ever made a decision for myself in life, He set me apart. He sanctified me. As I said, we get this word sacred, holy from this word. He looks upon you as sacred, as holy. Now, there are many ways we can define that word holy. You know one way we can define the word holy? Different. God is holy. What does that mean? He is different than we are. His ways are not our ways. His thoughts are not our thoughts. When Isaiah got his vision of God in the temple, he said, those angels in that antiphonal chorus were singing, "Holy, holy, holy." He was high and set apart. The train of His robe filled the temple. He was different from everyone else. God looks upon you as different. You're different from everyone else. God is saying that He set you apart. You! What a testimony you have of what God did for you before you were ever born. You know, there are not a lot of things that are called holy in the Bible. Now, there was a room in the temple, as you know, that was called what? The Holy of Holies. What does that mean? That means that room was different from every other room in the temple. You didn't play volleyball in that room. You didn't go in that room and play dominoes. It was different from every other room. It was there. The ark was kept. It was there that once a year the high priest on the Day of Atonement would enter. It was there that the Shekinah glory of God would come between those wings of that those seraphim and fill the room. It was different. It was called holy. There are not a lot of things called holy. I'll tell you another thing that's called holy were the vessels that were used in temple worship. Now what does that mean? That means they were different from every other kind of vessel. You didn't drink tea out of one of those cups. They were different. They were set apart. They were holy. In that Jewish dispensation, there was a day of the year, of the week, that was called holy. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it what? Holy. What does that mean? Different. There was one day of their week that was different from every other day. And what they did on those other 6 days of the week, they did not do on that day because it was different. Leviticus tells us something else was called holy. Says the tithe is holy unto the Lord. For those Jewish people, there was a part of their money that was different from all the rest of it. It was that tenth of it, that tithe of it, that was different from all the other 90% of it. And it was to be set apart as holy. I'm simply illustrating the fact that it just means different. Look at this verse in verse 5. Of Jeremiah 1. Before you were born, God knew you, but He set you apart from everyone else. Same word. Same word as He used to describe the Holy of Holies in the temple. Same that He used to describe those vessels or the Sabbath or the tithe or any of those other things. You are holy to Him. You are sacred to Him. He has sanctified you. He has set you apart. You are different from anyone else He ever created. Thus, to use your life for any other reason than to glorify Him is a sacrilege. You have a testimony of what He did for you before you were born. You're indescribably valuable to Him. And the tragedy is that so many of us go through life and some go through ministry and never come to the reality of this incredible truth that there is design behind your life, that there is purpose behind your life. What did God do for you before you were born? He knew you. He set you apart. Do you see it? What an incredible testimony you have. Here's the third part of your testimony. He gave me a job. He gave me a job. For Jeremiah, it was this. I ordained you a prophet to the nations. Now, that's not your job, but that was Jeremiah's. But He has given you a job. We get our proper name, Nathan, from this Hebrew word. It means to appoint, to assign. To set in place, to designate. In fact, interestingly enough, the same word is found in Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, when it says that God, this Creator God, set, S-E-T, the stars in their courses. Same word. Each one has a place. They run in clock-like precision. Just as He set the stars in their courses in the heavens. God uses the same word to describe the fact that somewhere there's something for you to do that no one else can do like you can do. And it has been so before you were ever born. He ordained you. He gave you a job. And again, the verb tense says it is past completed action. Before you were ever born, this was true. There is purpose. There is design. There is a plan behind your life. And thus, success in life is the ability to then discover the will of God for your life and then to do it. True success in life. I was with your president last night and I learned something new. I learned something new about him every time I'm with him, but I learned that he has a little bit of a knack for carpentry and for working with his hands. I would have never guessed it. And I saw some of the product of his hands, not just his head and his heart. And I was thinking this morning when I was getting up and looking at this verse of an experience that happened when our youngest daughter, Holly, was at TCU in Fort Worth. And she had finished her freshman year and she was moving into an apartment with a couple of her close friends and roommates. And so my wife Susie and I was pastor in Dallas at the time. My wife Susie and I went over to Fort Worth and to help fix up her apartment and put some furniture in. And Susie and Holly went back into the back room and they left me with an assignment. Now, I'm not real good working with my hands as a carpenter or whatever, but I had a pretty easy assignment. It was a little pedestal table in a box, unassembled. Had a little bitty tabletop on it, and then just one pedestal down, and then some of those 90-degree, I don't know what you call them, but you screw things into them and put it on top of the pedestal. So my only task was to take that tabletop, turn it upside down, put the pedestal on it, and just screw four screws around it in the proper place. And they were those Phillips screws with the cross in it. Well, I couldn't find a Phillips screwdriver, so I went in the kitchen where we'd just gotten her some silverware, and I got one of the kitchen knives. And I came back in a minute, and I started working trying to screw those things in. Well, the bottom of that thing just all scarred and cut up and everything. My knuckles were where I was doing. About that time, my wife Susie walked through and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, I'm just trying to get this thing screwed in." And she looked at the kitchen knife, and the end of it was
irreparable. It was just bent all to smithereens. And she walked over to her little tool chest she's got with the little flowers painted on it, and she opened it up, which I should have done, and she pulled out a Phillips screwdriver and tossed it over to me and said, "Use this." I put that Phillips screwdriver into that screw. Oh, it felt so good. And I began to turn it, and it were, and it was turning, and I got that screw down there so tight, it felt so good. Why? Because that screwdriver was doing what it had been designed and made to do. Somewhere, there's a job for you to do. This purpose that's behind your life, and it feels so good when you discover whose you are, that He knew you, and that He set you apart, and that He has ordained you, and there's a job for you to do that no one else can do like you can do. The difference between that kitchen knife and that Phillips screwdriver was that screwdriver was doing what it was intended, what it was made and designed to do. And here some of us are trying to go through life, and it just doesn't feel right. But when you discover what God did for you before you were born, and you find His will for your life, it feels so right. Why? Because you're beginning to do what God designed you and purposed and planned for you to do before you were ever born. So here we are. He knew me. He set me apart. He gave me a job. And then what do? Well, sometimes I do the same thing Jeremiah did. Whoa. Look at verse 6. Then said I, "Oh, Lord God, sovereign Lord," is really what he said. Anytime you wake up to verse 5, that's what you'll call him. "I cannot speak. I'm too young. I'm but a youth. But the Lord said to me, 'Do not say I am a youth. For you shall go to all to whom I send you, and whatever I command you, you shall speak. Do not be afraid of their faces, for I am with you to deliver you.'" To deliver you. You see, the truth is strength actually comes from our weakness. And when Jeremiah came to grips with what God did for him before he was born, those excuses vanished. "I am with you." F.B. Meyer put it like this: "From the foot of the cross where we were cradled in our second birth to the brink of the river where we will lay down our armor, there is a path which He has prepared for us to walk before you were born." You have one final part of your testimony. What God did for you back there before you were born. He knew me. He set me apart. He gave me a job. And here's the fourth part of your testimony. He formed me. He formed me. Look at your testimony. All that action before this is in past completed action. It's perfect tense. Now we find a different verb tense that indicates this is continuous action. Yes, there's that sense in which He formed us in the womb, but one might also add that this is a continual process of Him forming us and fashioning us into a thing of beauty, into His purpose and plan for our lives. Listen to verse 5. "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you." This brings about an issue that's seldom heard in the abortion debate, because so much of the abortion debate is taken up with the present, that we are taking and extinguishing the life of an innocent, unborn human being. Others of the debate is taken up with the future, the emotional stress and the post-abortion syndromes and the other issues that take place in the future, in the aftermath of abortion. But what about the past? Abortion doesn't just take a life, but it messes with God's eternal plan for an individual. It's not just the sanctity of life that is at issue, but it is God's plan and purpose for each of our lives. So here we are. He knew me. He set me apart.
He gave me a job.
And he formed me. The Hebrew word appears dozens of times in the Old Testament. And it means to squeeze into shape, to form, to fashion, to frame. It's found also in that familiar passage in the same book, Jeremiah chapter 18, when he goes down to the potter's house and he sees that potter at the wheel fashioning and forming and molding and making that clay into the image that's the design of his mind for that lump of clay. To squeeze into shape so that it fits perfectly into that which he has designed. Closely akin to this, I was reading devotionally in Kings the other day. 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 7 has an incredible statement. It says that when the temple was being constructed, that the stones, those big, huge stones that went into the temple, were all cut at the quarry. And then they were brought to Temple Mount so that, quote, no hammer or chisel, the sound of no hammer nor chisel was heard when the temple was assembled. That is amazing. That perfect form. God formed you for a specific place where you fit. You don't have to take a chisel and chisel it out to try to make yourself fit somewhere. God has formed you and fashioned you for a place where you fit. And today He desires you to fit into that place He has for you. Some people live their lives in frustration, always trying to find a place to fit. The issue is not who you are or what you are to do. The first issue is to rediscover whose you are. He is forming you for a special purpose. Some of you may be here for the first weeks. Maybe you want to throw up some excuses, as did Jeremiah. But maybe you just need to remember that behind your life is a sovereign God who knows you and who set you apart, who's given you a job and who's in the process still of forming you and fashioning you on this campus to fit perfectly into His will for your life. The New Testament equivalent is found in Ephesians, of course, in the second chapter. We often quote those first verses of verses 8 and 9, for by grace we're saved through faith. What about verse 10? For we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto good works, which God hath before ordained that we should walk therein. For we are His workmanship. You know what word we get from that workmanship in the language of the New Testament? Poema. Poema. We get our word poem from that word. You're God's poem. You're God's work of art. There's design behind your life. There is purpose behind your life. What God did for us before we were born. You have a testimony as you go your way today. A testimony of what God did for you before you were born. He knew you. He set you apart from everyone else. You're different. He gave you a job that no one else can do like you can do. And He formed you not only in the womb, but He uses experiences like you're involved in on this campus to form you and to fashion you into something, someone of beauty, fitting exactly where He's planned you to fit before you were ever born. My wife Susie and I were in Israel a few years ago. We traveled to Israel two or three times a year for 25 years. And we were there 4 or 5 years ago, and we were praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. Not the Garden of Gethsemane that most of the people go to. There's old big old olive trees over 2,000 years of age that witnessed the agony of Christ and that big iron bar around. Can't go in. But most people don't know that that garden extends to the north, and right across a little one-lane road behind a rock stone wall is a private garden, the extension of the Gethsemane garden. It's owned by a man that lives up in Abu Tur. We made friends with him years ago, and he lets us go and pray in that garden. We were in there early one morning, sunrise, my wife Susie and I and two or three other friends. We were sitting on a rock, and we were praying about some circumstances and situations in our lives and having our devotional time. And I looked down, and on a blade of grass down there at my feet, on that blade of grass were several diamonds that were just stuck on there, sparkling diamonds. I thought, man, this is a miracle. And I obviously didn't think that, but I it caught my eye. I reached down and I picked off that little blade of grass and I brought it up. Of course, they weren't diamonds. They were droplets of dew. Early that morning, when I walked across from the room where I was staying this morning, there was dew all over the grass. And I looked at that blade of grass with that dew all over it, sparkling that modern, early Mid-Eastern sun, and a verse came into my mind that I memorized as a teenager after I was saved and hadn't thought of in over 30 years. It's an obscure verse. I guess I heard a sermon on it one time. I don't know. It's Hosea 14:5. God said, "I will be like the dew to my people. I'll be like the dew to Israel." What does that mean? I looked at that blade of grass and that verse came into my mind. I'll be like the dew to my people. Well, listen, you got up this morning, there was dew all over the grass. Where'd it come from? Does dew rise or does dew fall? Well, let me give you the answer. The answer is neither. It just appears when certain conditions are right. God said, "I will be like the dew to my people." Oh, we pray, "God, come down. Oh, Lord, rise." No, He just appears when certain conditions are right. That's what Jesus said to the disciples. Luke 24:49. "Go and tarry in the upper room until you be endued with power." Middle voice. The subject acts upon himself. He didn't tell them to go in there and wait around in the upper room until they had this experience. No, He said, "You go in there and endue yourself. Go in there and get right. When conditions are right, God shows up. I'll be like the dew to my people," He said. It's not who you are. It's whose you are that matters most.